Hey everybody, happy Friday. It's Aaron Norris. Got a little bit of a cold. I'm getting the sound from last week up. We did have a lot of technical problems, and sometimes we tried everything to do what we could, and just nothing would work. So today, luckily, the sound is a little bit better, and let's get started. Richest Man in Babylon, over to you, Pops.
Happy Friday, everybody. Guess the first thing we ought to do is take a look at the goals that we had in mind. I hope everybody's doing well with that. I started out at 220, and I am at 199.2. My goal was 200, and so I made that. What feels really good is that I took a little time this morning, and I tried on all the suits I have in my closet. And I did that for, I guess, to put a smile on my face. I have three suits that I have to retire because they fall off of me if I wear them. So that's a good thing. Two are big, so they will be gone in the next 2 weeks and unwearable. I have two that fit, and I have one skinny suit. And that was the suit that I wore in 2005 after the first Millionaire Maker, and I will be able to wear that 3 weeks from today. So I just kind of gave that as a, I don't know, a feel good thing for me today. I don't intend to go back to this weight ever again. So this is kind of special to me as I say goodbye to 220 and 210, 210 and 200. I don't intend to see those things anymore. And it's one of the reasons why we had the Millionaire Maker this year was Bruce Norris needed it. I wanted to change some things. I wanted to return to the person that could make promises to myself and keep them. Because whatever I go after next, and I'm still working on that goal list, I want to bring with it somebody that can make a promise to themselves and keep it. And so this is a much more about the future than it is losing weight. But for whatever reason, weight has always been the issue that I have had haunt me over and over again, and this time I'm going to get it permanently solved. That feels really good. I know myself fairly well and how I work, and so it also doesn't hurt to have a public statement that I've got to do something. So when you stand in front of a group of people that you care about, you say, okay, 60 days from now I'm going to weigh 189.5 pounds. You don't leave yourself a lot of outs. And I would be very disappointed in myself if I took that promise lightly. So I don't. So anyway, it's been a very good week. I have had really no temptation to eat anything wrong. That's been the other thing, is I've kept 100% of the promise. I didn't just end up at that weight. I've eaten exactly the way I intended to. I've exercised the way I intended to. And what's important about that is I'm developing those habits along the way that will take me into the next goal setting round, whatever that might be, with a more disciplined person. And that's to me, that was the goal. The book that we had to read, The Richest Man in Babylon, this had a very big influence on me because of, I guess, when I read it. I was pretty young. A lot of the concepts were new to me. And so as simple as this book is, I can't tell you how many dozens of copies I've given it out over the years, and I have to say that I have had very few people follow anything that it says. And it's so simple, yet apparently it's not human nature to do what this book is suggesting. The story starts out with a discouraged man. There's this guy, Banser, who's sitting on a wall and he's contemplating his plight. He doesn't have what he wants. And he's worked hard, he feels, and yet he's got nothing that really puts a smile on his face as far as material things. He's looking at other people with wealth, and he just doesn't get why he's not there. And I think I related to this guy when I read this book the first time. Just from my start, getting married at 17, having two kids before I was 19, and I got fired 5 times in a row. Usually I worked two jobs, and so I was working from 8 in the morning to 10 at night. That was very common And we didn't have a home. We rented an apartment. Sometimes when we started, it was furnished. And I remember thinking, I am so far over my head. I don't see any possible way out. And also in the very beginning, Banser has his wife come out of the out of their humble home and gaze at him with concern. She's worried about how things are. You know, we need you to finish this chariot, pal, and there you are sitting on the fence contemplating. And so sometimes that's what happens is you just almost, you feel like you're frozen. You don't know what to do, even though it's right in front of you what you've got to do. I was fortunate in that I had the kind of wife that learned to inspire me rather than nag. I'm sure she was at some point looking at this young man she married going, wow, I didn't know he was going to get fired. I didn't know this was all going to happen. But she was very patient with all of that. And I remember that she really knew how to inspire me, and that was a much better way. She enticed me to the next level many, many times. And then I kind of picked up that ball, and I realized that that was my job to do, that I had to learn to motivate myself. And I started thinking about that and, you know, what made me want to get to the next level without anybody else's assistance. And part of what I learned was I was motivated by past negative experiences. Because my goal happened to be weight loss, I have a lot of things that have happened in my life where being heavy, being fat, had an impact. And temporarily, I'll be very good and correct that. You know, when you go shopping as a kid, when I was 12 years old, you'd go to a guy and he'd go, okay, well, you can't wear the regular. You have to wear Husky. Husky is the code word for it. This is a fat kid. So I always had that in my mind, that was who I was. I remember trying to climb a rope when I was in 9th or 10th grade, and I probably made it, you know, 4 feet off the ground and just hung there like a sack of meat. And a kid took a look at me, and he said, you know, if I were you, I'd be embarrassed. And that made me mad. And I remember losing weight that summer because that irritated me. There's stories like that that I remember and kind of sticks in my craw. And if I pay attention to those things, it's helpful. I also have, you know, been poor. And so I remember those feelings of having a car. I remember having a car that smoked so bad that it was embarrassing. Literally, when I was parked at a light, you couldn't see me because the car smoked that bad. So I learned to use some of those negative experiences and get myself to try harder to get to the next level without anybody else, and that was important. I realized that I can get very motivated when I get angry. So I look for reasons to actually get there. I look for people that are rude or nasty to help me get where I want to go. And I don't mind if they show up. Actually, I even sometimes write it down. When I broke my Achilles tendon playing racquetball, there was a guy, after I returned to the racquetball place on crutches, he came up to me and he said, what happened to you? And I said, oh, I broke an Achilles tendon. And his comment was, oh, good, that's the end of you. And I remember thinking, gosh, what a jerk. Only it was in stronger terms that I really thought that. But he did me such a big favor because I would have never had the next 90 days without his help. He ticked me off. And in 90 days, I got lighter. I got in shape despite being on crutches because I worked my butt off. And way ahead of schedule, I go on a racquetball court, and I'm warming up in the challenge court, which has a glass back. And he happened to come in, and he opened the side door, and he looked in, and he says, are you here for real? And I said, I'm here for you. And that's what he did for me. He got me to the point where I would try harder to show him who he was dealing with than I probably would have any other way. I also have the side that I'm motivated to put a smile on the face of people that I love. And I know that about myself, so I look for reasons to do that. And this is what's important. You've got to figure out what makes yourself tick. For whatever reason, there's a guy in my life named John Stevenson. He's a friend of mine, and I used to sell him electrical stuff. I've known him for a long time, going on 25-plus years. But there's been times in our life that it's kind of like we grew up as men together. He owned a business, and he built a custom home before I did. But it challenged me. I thought, well, if John can build a custom house, I can build a custom house. And sure enough, wasn't too much longer to where I did have the motivation to do that, and I built a custom home. Every time I've wanted to lose weight seriously, I call John Stevenson up, so we have a bet. Because I know one thing, that when I bet John Stevenson, there's something clicks off in my brain that I will not lose to John Stevenson, and I've never have. And it's not like I'm pulling against him. We make bets that both of us can win. But have someone in your life that you're competitive with that turns your switch on and makes you try harder and be better. That's an important thing. This gentleman, Banzer, had a good friend come over early in the story, and he wanted to borrow some money, and he didn't have it. And it was very frustrating because, you know, then they found out they're really both in the same situation. And Banzer wanted to be this man of wealth, and he thought that he was willing to work with all his might to get that accomplished. But what life had been doing is every time he made a dime, it found a place to go. And so he had nothing left at the end of the month. They decided to talk to this guy named Arcad. Arcad was known to be the wealthiest person in the area. And what they heard maybe wasn't what they wanted to hear. Maybe they thought it was going to be, well, here, let me share my stuff with you. That wasn't going to happen. And if they thought they were going to hear an elaborate plan, they probably didn't hear that either. And he begins by saying, if you're not wealthy, it's because you have either failed to learn the laws that govern the building of wealth, or else you do not observe them. It kind of put it back in their lap. In other words, what you guys are after, you can find out. And if you know them and you're not observing them, it's still up to you. So it was great, we're there for advice, but you know what? Maybe you've already had enough time to deal with this, and you haven't used your time well. And apparently Arcad looked at his future early on, and he decided a couple things. And there's quotes in the book that I like. I like this book especially well for some of the quotes. And one of them is that he decided, I would claim my share of good things in life. And a second one is, I would make myself a guest at the banquet of good things. I like both of those quotes because what it boiled down to is it was within his power. He saw that he could accomplish this if he concentrated on it. And he said in the book, with no special gifts and no chance of an inheritance, I would have to study and learn for myself. And that's what he had done. One of the excuses that people have that don't have any substance is they don't have time. And Arcad put that one to rest. He says, each of us has had sufficient time to have attained wealth. It's just in the choice of how we chose to spend our time that made the difference. And he also talked about different types of ways to learning to know and learning how to find out what you don't know. And I found that very interesting because in the industry that we're in, it's never been easier to understand how to find information, how to become good at what we do, and yet very few people really become experts at this business, even though it's at their fingertips. So it's all there. It's a wise use of time and a plan to find out what you don't know and learn it. The first lesson that he talked about to them, and he he even knew that it was going to come across as too simple to be of value. And yet he was trying to get them to take it seriously, because he said, if you miss this, I don't know how to help you. And the first lesson was, a part of all you earn is yours to keep. Yeah, how simple is that? And I remember the process when I first started to say, okay, I mean, I'm making $1.35 an hour. It's whatever that is, $55, $56 a week gross. And I'm supposed to take 10% of that and put it in some hole somewhere and save it. And it seemed like a lot to ask. It really did. But I decided that we would do that. And we actually had a can in the kitchen, and we tried to put money in that as often as we could, but no less than that 10%. I wasn't sure what that was for, that can, but I think Marcia did. I think she wanted to own a house, and so that's what we started. And there's a quote in the book that says, wealth like a tree grows from a tiny seed. And you couldn't have much of a smaller seed than what we had started with. But that was our start. And a couple years later, with extra money that we had put in there, we had accumulated enough for a down payment on a house. And so that little savings plan took hold, and we became a homeowner within a couple years. One thing that we noticed in the book states that once you get in the habit of living on less than you make, you don't miss it. And there's magic in that little pile of money that you have control of, that's extra. And I really used to love watching it grow. I used to have a little savings book, and I'd go in there and, you know, add $5 or $10 or whatever it was, maybe even work some extra overtime to where I could add some more into it. But whatever was in there, it was always growing. It's exactly the same feeling as losing weight, and you see the scale constantly saying a new number. It's very encouraging to start the habit of saying that my life is going to change, and I'm going to start putting this money aside for our future. It really doesn't matter the amount. It matters that you develop the habit. I have had many discussions with people starting with this habit. And usually it's somebody coming into to talk to me about getting them a house, giving them a house, to be more accurate. Okay, I'll be more than happy to help you, but here's what I'd like you to do. First of all, I'd like you to read this book, and then I'd like you to save according to the plan, and in 1 year, I would like you to have set aside the amount of money that it asks you to do. I have never had anyone fulfill their side of the bargain. It was just too much to ask. They didn't want to participate with their effort. And if I, let's say, maybe the first example of that is 25 years ago, that person has never implemented the lesson number one of setting aside anything for themselves, and to this day they have nothing. And yet, if you look at how much they made as much as other people. They just never set aside anything that would be theirs to grow, and it's made all the difference. So wherever you are in your finances, you've got to develop a habit that says, you know what, I don't care how little it is, it's life-changing when it becomes yours to play with, yours to invest, yours to, now it also forces you, now you're an investor. So you have to learn how to have the skills, how to invest that. The first mistake it talks about, remember, he gets the hang of what he's supposed to do, and he does it well, and he saves his money. And the rich guy comes back and says, okay, have you done what we asked? Yeah, I've saved the money. He said, what did you do with it? And he said, I gave it to somebody to invest. And the wise man laughed and said, well, you've just kissed off your savings because you handed it to somebody that doesn't know what he's doing. And it was true. And so that's the first thing you have to realize when you become an investor, you have to become personally responsible for where that money gets directed. maybe best of all, it gets directed under your control, or at least you have skill enough to ask the right questions to where you invest it with somebody that knows what to do. But that first year of savings quickly went by the wayside, and he had to start again. And start again he did. The habit was there, so he saved another year. And the wise man, the rich man, came back and said, "It's great, you've done it again. What did you do? And he said, "Well, we saved, and that money's earned some money, and then we threw a great party." And he was very happy to have had the banquet. But the rich guy just laughed and said, "You've just spent the children of your savings." He said, "If you want to be wealthy, you have to have that money, earn money, and that money that earns money, make more money. And that's all of a sudden how you end up having enough money someday where you can have all the banquets you want without any effect." I have definitely seen this habit happen to people, that either one of two things. Every once in a while, there's a windfall to somebody in my life that doesn't have the discipline of being a saver. And instead of saying, "Okay, well, this is sort of a lucky break here. I never have been able to save this, but I am going to invest this wisely and make it grow," that isn't what happens. There's pent-up banquet plans, whatever that banquet may be, and that's where the money goes. And then I don't care how much money it is, be it $10,000 or $100,000, given enough time, it's the zero, and nothing has changed in their life. And it goes right back to, they never developed a habit with $5. And if you do not develop a habit with small amounts, you're not going to improve your odds of developing that habit when it's $100,000. You just don't do that. The book had an interesting quote. It says, "Opportunity wastes no time with the unprepared." That's very true. I've noticed that when you have money that's extra and that's available, opportunity finds you, and it passes people by that aren't ready for it. And I just, it's been a frustration. I've had to get over it because I can't control other people's actions, but it's such a simple concept that you wonder why people won't take that first step, but often they don't. One of the things it also talked about was his understanding that when he made a promise to himself, and this was the setting aside of his 10% of his money, how important that was to whatever else he wanted to accomplish. There's a quote, it says, "If I set for myself a task, be it ever so trifling, I shall see it through. How else shall I have the confidence in myself to do important things?" And that's what this whole journey is about, the 60 days, is whatever promise you kept or you made to yourself, that was why you needed to keep it, because it's going to grow from here. You're going to be that person that once again can promise yourself something and pull it off. And that feels awfully good. And one of the other things that's said in the book, by starting the savings habit, you'll realize what a rich feeling it is to own a treasure upon which you alone have claim. And as that grew, and as I invested that money, it started to have a life of its own. And I remember as it grew to a whole year's worth of money, life started to feel much safer. I literally had enough money that I had, if something happened, I had a year's worth of money behind me. And Mike Cantu said something interesting to me, and I may have been in the interview or may have been personally, but he's a very conservative guy, and you know, his goal was to get the cash flow from 10 houses, and then he thought, well, I'll have a backup plan and I'll do another 10. But that all comes from a habit of setting aside money that doesn't have a claim on it, that is allowed to grow, and the more skillful you are, the more it gets to grow. What happens when somebody wealthy shares plans like this with other people? You have you have numbers of different reactions. You have people go away saying they're interested, and then ultimately they completely ignore it. You'll have some people say that's so simple to be not of value, and so they never do it, but they also just criticize it. And every once in a while you get somebody that'll replicate it. And when the rich man came back, who do you think that he met with? He met with those people that were doing what he asked them to do. And they continue to learn from him and continue to get maybe the progression of knowledge that occurred in the rich man's life. I remember attending Jim Rohn's seminars. And when I first met him, it was to be a millionaire is what he talked about. And then 8 years later, that goal had changed, and it was something else that was even bigger. And then the last time I heard him speak, it wasn't so much about making it anymore. It was being able to give 90% of what you made a year away. And I thought, you know what, son of a gun, I'm never going to catch this guy. But it was a cool mentor to have, because as he progressed and as I had earned the right to have an audience with him, he never failed to raise the bar for me. And that's what happens to people that start to realize that some of this is in your control. And when you develop these habits, you start changing maybe the sphere of influence that you have on other people, but you also maybe get to change who you hang around with and who you get influenced by. In the book, it talks about 7 cures for a lean purse. And the first one, start the purse to fattening, so you just have to learn to save. Controlling your expenditures. So it talks about learning to live off of 70% of what you make and paying down debt. A lot of times, and I've done this, so some of you have heard me tell the Mercedes stories, you know, that first phase of money in the, you know, I started in the business in 1980, 81. By the time 85 rolled around, I had a Mercedes lease that was 900 and something dollars a month. I didn't control expenditures. I wanted people to know that I was doing well. Of course, if I was doing that well, I guess I could have written a check for it. But I wanted, I guess, somebody to look at that car and say, okay, well, that guy's doing something special. It's hard to control that originally, but you get over it after a while, and maybe that's part of maturing. And so that's a good thing, is to live within your means and constantly think of, you know, ways to set aside money to where you can let it grow. And that's the third one, make the gold that you save multiply. Make it grow, don't spend it, let it grow, have its life of its own, let it stay there. I've always been conservative, and I don't know where this came from, but I remember as a kid I'd have a quarter that maybe I was my allowance, and I'd go into a store, and my mom would always tell me that it was my habit never to buy something that took all of it. I'd always say, okay, how much is this? And I would want to make sure that I got change. I'm still like that to this day. I have little piles of money or something in reserve always in multiple places in case who knows what happens. That's just the nature of who, you know, who I've wanted to become, because it makes that part of my world feel safe. Another thing it talks about is guard your treasure. So, you know, that has a lot of ways that your wealth can disappear. Getting extravagant, handing it to the wrong persons, not protecting it with the proper way to, let's say, hold title, things like that. So you've got to get good at establishing wealth and then to protect it. There's been a couple times under the guard thy treasure. Apparently, I've just had one too many $250,000 chunks, and I've given them away sometimes. And you just go, wow, what a silly thing that was to do. I had a friend that was busy in Mexico building homes, and I didn't know it at the time. I thought I was investing $250,000 in what he was doing, but I basically just donated it. And it really wasn't his fault, but I didn't know anything about Mexico. I didn't know that it could be dangerous, and it turned out that it was, and he had to leave. And when he left, my $250,000 stayed behind. And it was one of those lessons, and that's why these books are really good to read every year, because we're all susceptible to making some of the same mistakes over and over again. So guard your treasure. Don't make silly mistakes. Make thy dwelling a profit center. That was, of course, a big deal. You know, when you're renting an apartment, you're married at 17, you got, you know, bad start of getting fired all the time. To actually have your name on a piece of real estate, even though the windows didn't open, even though the toilet didn't flush in the right direction, to have a grant deed in your name saying that you were in fact a property owner was a big deal. Just in my head, that was a big deal. And never really thinking how lucky we were to get into that spot in about 1974. We owned that property a couple of years or three or four, and it went up, and when we sold it, we netted $10,000. And that was the beginning of thinking of real estate in a different way. I remember talking to Marcia saying, can we take this $10,000 and buy three homes instead of one? And there, I had not taken any real estate courses. I didn't know of the buy-sell business. I didn't know anything about that. I just knew that I was making, at the time, about 10 grand a year, and I just bought a house and made 10 grand in a day, is how I looked at it. And I thought, I would like to do that more often. And so from that little habit of saving $5 came a $10,000 check that turned into three houses that turned in later to a fortune. And it all started with the ability to save enough money to where I could make my residence a profit center. So that's one of the things investors can do. You can own a house, you put a credit line on it, don't have to have cash, just have to have access to it. And I've done an awful lot of business off of a credit line on a residence. Ensure a future income. And I really wasn't shown that model for a long time. I didn't follow it. I thought it was much more exciting to buy and sell and buy and sell. And a gentleman named Jack Fullerton, Mick Blackwell, Mike Cantu, there's people in my life that finally convinced me that what if something happens to you? Your business model is constantly dependent on you doing something. And I realized that that was a much smarter plan, was to get the assets to pay me money. And I remember making now all of a sudden a conscious effort, okay, I'm going to take care of the monthly nut. And just like Mike Cantu, okay, well, now that I've done that once, I think I'll do that again. And I'll do that again. And it has been one of the big reliefs of my life during especially a time where you own a business, let's say when business was very slow and intentionally so in, say, 2007 and 8, where we knew we couldn't do a lot of hard money loans safely, that I didn't have to worry about income because I had already had that arranged. It allows for very sane decision making. And so that was one of the side benefits of having income, was I didn't have to chase things down when things were very hard. The last thing in that section, it says increase your ability to earn money. And so that's one thing this business has always allowed, is for if I have a bigger dream or I have something else to pursue, I've usually been able to ratchet up my knowledge and effort and create what I've wanted to create in pretty short order. It's so much better than working for somebody and trying to ask for a raise. The book has a section called Five Laws of Gold. Gold comes to those that set aside money. Mike Cantu refers it as dry powder. Always have some dry powder for somebody to call you with something and that you're ready to pull the trigger on in a second's notice, because you've already prepared for that. I've definitely noticed that opportunity seems to search out liquidity. And you have to put yourself in that position. And if you put yourself in that position often enough, you're known for having the money for deals. And consequently, you get more calls. It's really pretty simple. So set aside some money and get known for it. The second one in that five laws for goals is gold comes to those who employ their money wisely. And the key is the wise part. Employ it in something that you personally know is one choice. I really don't like delegating my money outside of my own knowledge bank, and that's a personal preference. You know, people talk about, we have all your eggs in one basket. Yeah, but I really know the basket. And where would you like me to send my money? And usually it's someplace I have no idea what they're talking about. I heard on the radio yesterday as I was driving around, the new hot ticket for huge hedge funds is to put money in growth areas of Africa. And I just shake my head and go, okay, well, that's, what if something goes wrong? I don't know how to fix that. I don't even understand what you're talking about. So I like the fact that what we deal with, we all understand. We've all owned a house. We understand what it's like to own a rental and have a renter or have a trust deed. All of that stuff is within our capacity to understand. We don't have to go too much further out of that. Employ your money in something that pays income, and employ it in something that can go up in value. Fortunately, again, we have the right asset for that. Number three, under five laws of gold, gold clings to people who use the counsel of wise people. So part of this building of wealth is to surround yourself with people that you trust, that know what they're talking about in various categories. So you have to talk to people about how they invested their money. What type? When I started keeping rentals, I talked to Mike. I said, Mike, what's the prototype rental? And it wasn't 3,000 square foot, two-story house. It was really a boring structure, a three-bedroom, two-bath, 1,400 square foot, single-story. Well, guess what I own? That's what I own, because I didn't want to recreate the wheel. It seemed like that was a good wheel, and I adopted it. But I didn't have to go through the trial and error. I got to ask somebody that I knew understood that. Tax advisors. You know, that's one of the difficult things when you start having income that's high, is that you have to figure a way out how to not give half of it to the government. So you surround yourself with people that understand that. You have to say, okay, can I set some of this money in a retirement account? And how much can I set aside in a retirement account? I found out over the last few years there was a vehicle that we have access to, and I'm talking about we investors have access to, called a defined benefit plan. And I had heard of this before. I had known two investors that had put money in that type of thing. And, you know, in the last year I finally asked enough questions to understand what it was. And it allowed me to put in a retirement account in one year, $250,000. Well, that was a big deal. And had I got around to it, I could have done it before that, but I didn't. But I finally got around to it. So it really helps to surround yourself with some people that are on the cutting edge of a piece of the business that you're probably not going to be an expert at, but you need to have expertise that you can listen to. And also an entity expert, you know, how to hold title to a property to where you're protected in case something bad happens. Fourth law of goals, a gold slippeth away from people who deal in unfamiliar businesses or people. I've had more than a couple lessons in this one. Good friend, my best friend Alex, he was in the car business, and he used to go to an auction in Orange County. And he took me there one day, and I was pretty excited because I liked the action, and he left me alone for 5 minutes, and five minutes later, I owned three cars. Now, I don't understand about cars, but they look like good deals to me. And on the fourth one, I walked up as they were auctioning off. They had maybe six rows of cars, so you couldn't be in all the rows at that one time. And on this particular row, I walked up to it, and there was a four-door Fleetwood Brougham in perfect condition, and the bid was $2,900, and I just acknowledged that I would bid that, and instantly he said, sold. I was so happy. I got in the car. It was immaculate inside. It was really a great deal, and they had a driver. He drove the car around to the outside, and I got out, and at that time, I actually looked around the car for the first time, and I was a little unhappy to notice that it had been hit on the other side. So I had a perfect car on three sides, but not on the fourth. And I guess you realize that, that matters to the buyer that I might want to sell that to. So that was one of my lessons of realizing that somebody very inexperienced just got hammered and learned a lesson. I've watched people do that in real estate auctions. I've sat next to people who are bidding on a property that literally was burnt inside to a crisp. So determined were they to buy it that even though I presented evidence that I had seen the property and written burnt across the description for that particular item in the auction, they were not deterred and they were the winning bidder on a $53,000 purchase of a burnt house. Oddly enough, the only way to get to $53,000 is to have a lot of competitors helping you along. So there were a number of people, just like me, not willing to go on the other side of a car, who were not willing to get out of the car and go inside a front door to protect $50,000. And so that's what this lesson is your gold's going to slip away from you if you deal with unfamiliar businesses or people that you can't trust. So it's very difficult when you say goodbye to a big chunk of money, especially in those days where you're saving it a piece at a time. When that first piece gets put together and you waste it all, it's just like you've torn a year out of your life and tossed it in the trash can. So when you invest, make sure you know who you're handing it to and take your time choosing those people. We know of an investor that invests a fair amount of money in our trustees, and he sold a business and had a lot of wealth. He took 2 years before he placed that money, carefully picking his future team partners. And it's always been an interesting thing doing business with him because he's so methodical and he just won't do something unwise or quickly. So it's been interesting watching him operate. The fifth law of gold is gold flees from people who try to get excessive earnings. I was in Northern California, and I was speaking to a group of Chinese investors, and there was one particular conversation that didn't make a lot of sense to me at the time, but now I've heard sort of the rest of the story, and I realized where he was coming from. I speak in front of this group of Chinese investors, and at the end of it, it's a Q&A, and the gentleman tells me that he has bought a $1 million home, a year and a half ago in some area of San Jose, and today it's worth $2 million, and he's not going to sell it until it's worth $7 million. I just was astounded by that statement, and nothing could deter him to think that that wouldn't be true. An easy triple from having already doubled. And I thought, okay, well, he must be one of a kind. And then I talked to somebody very recently that had investments in China, and these are the actual numbers. They bought two properties for an equivalent of $50,000 US, $50,000 apiece, and a third property at $100,000 apiece. And they've owned them for several years, and the properties have gone up 10 times the amount on the first two. And those first two properties are nothing to brag about, a place you wouldn't want to stay in one night yourself. And they decided they would sell the properties, and they sold the $50,000 purchases for $500,000 apiece and the $100,000 purchase for $2 million apiece. What this Chinese investor was doing in Northern California is he had the expectation that what just played out in Beijing was about to play out in San Jose. And I thought that was very interesting that you have that kind of motivated buyer, but you also have the likelihood of that person is not going to cash out. He is trying to make excessive earnings because he's seen that happen before, and he's sure and he's betting on it's going to happen again. One of the things we saw when the downturn came, and we went through 2007 and transitioned to 2008 or 9, and even Mike Cantu said the game of looking at your net worth became less exciting as it continually went down. When people's net worth went down, we saw them make even bigger mistakes trying to get it bolstered back up with speed and aggression. And so there was a company that would sell a group of properties in let's say Detroit, 20 properties for $100,000. So let's say you had lost a bunch of money, but you still had $100,000. Wouldn't it be cool that you could take that $100,000 and then the next day say you own 20 free and clear properties? That just sounded like a really good idea to say that. Except for you probably didn't go see the properties and you probably didn't read the disclosures. And the disclosure was interesting. It said, the first line said, the properties that you have bought may in fact no longer exist. And the second disclosure was that if the property exists, it may have a lien on the city or by the city for an amount that exceeds the value of the property. The list of the disclosure was probably 20 items long. You would think that the first two would discourage most people, at least encourage them to go look at it. Nope, that's not what happened. They wanted to say that they had regained their wealth so much that they wrote that $100,000 check without ever looking at what they bought. Over and over and over again, that's what they did. So that's one way to make sure that your money, or in the story, your gold flees from your life, is to try to have it make excessive earnings. So be careful about that mindset. I remember being there with penny stocks. In early 2000, I mean early in January, probably January 2nd or 3rd, apparently I had $250,000 I wanted to say goodbye to. I didn't know that at the time, but I had watched my dad do some penny stock investing, and almost to protect him, I thought, you know what, I'll get involved in this world. And in December, I started paying attention to it, and I got kind of enthralled with it, and then I got passionate about it. And I wrote a $260,000 check in early January of 2000 and invested in penny stocks. And inside of about 45 days, it was worth $800,000+. And you would think that would be good enough, wouldn't you? I mean, 300% inside of 2 months. But no, I wasn't satisfied with that. As a matter of fact, I thought that I now had become a stock-picking genius, and so I literally started writing a penny stock course so I could help other people make wise decisions. Fortunately, I never got to teach that course. 45 days after that, my 250 turned it into 800, turned into 100, and I learned a lot about number 5 on this gold list is gold flees from people who try to get excessive earnings is a fact. And when you invested in things that you don't know about, it can leave really fast. So that's why when you have money that you have earned over a long period of time, that you have saved and diligently taken care of, you probably have better habits than if somebody just gave it to you. When people give you money, it goes by the wayside pretty quick because your thought process is very different. And that's one of the reasons why this book is important. It's really trying to tell you, this is the process of wealth. If by chance you lose it, the process still is there and it's available. But it's still the process. Start saving, take care of it, invest it. Don't spend the children of that investments. Make it grow until you get beyond your expenses, and then you can have a banquet whenever you want. That's pretty cool that this book allowed me to read that for the first time in my early 20s, and it made me think about how to be different, how to have a different life. Even though I was making very poor money, I decided to start setting aside money a piece at a time, and that never changed. I always had money set aside that was untouchable for any other reason. And that's literally what you have to do. You have to look at this money as it's untouchable. It is in an investment account, period. It doesn't buy washers and dryers or go on a vacation or have a banquet. It's to make my retirement safe and to make my future secure. And you really have to think of it that way. At the very end of the book, there's a chapter called The Luckiest Man in Babylon. and it's all about the love of hard work. There's a quote. It says, "Hard work is the best friend I have ever known." When I was a kid being raised by my dad, I did not have that impression of hard work. But I was shown a model of hard work. My dad was a hard worker, actually kind of legendary hard worker. He viewed it as a contest of manhood, I think, because even in his early 80s, he would go to a church and be part of their Saturday work potluck, and no one would want to compete with Paul Norris, the 80-year-old version, because he was still in the hole digging the trenches with the pickaxe. I noticed him limping, actually, one week, and I said, "You know, Dad, what's going on?" "I fell over backwards on a pile of dirt after swinging a pickaxe." And I just had to laugh because nothing changed. When I was being raised, he was in his 30s, and he was ridiculous at that time. Can you imagine, what he was like at that point? I watched that work ethic in place, and I really didn't like that because that was expected of me as a kid. So when we had chores, you were expected to get after it and work hard. And it took me a long time to appreciate that that's where all the goodies come from, is your willingness to do what someone else is not. Most of the fortune that I've made in real estate comes from my ability to look at something and say, this is available if I'm willing to do more than anyone else is willing to do, but I've got to do it right now. And I actually got to the point where I got excited when I would recognize those opportunities. When there was a HUD auction and there were 350 properties that I had to see in 12 days, I got happy because I realized there's not another nut in that auction that's going to do that. And so that was one of the reasons I did. And at the very end of the book, it says, my willingness to work made me the luckiest man in Babylon. So that's one of the things actually I look forward to, is that next thing in my life that I want to work that hard for, to where that puts a smile on my face. And because when you work that hard, you really don't have any competitors. You leave everybody else in the dust. And so that's one of my favorite chapters in this book, in The Richest Man in Babylon, is that it doesn't come down to, do you have degrees? Did you get inherited wealth? Do you make a lot of money? It usually boils down to, can you work harder than anybody else for whatever length of time a particular project needs you to do it? And I'd rather have that ability than any other ability in my life. My two sons that work in the company, Greg is legendary in a work ethic. I'll tell you a quick story. He was probably 13 years old. A minister at the time worked at our church. He used to be a college wrestler. His wife had a medical thing that they took care of, but then the insurance denied coverage, and at the time I had a fixer-upper, and I said, I'll tell you what, help me fix this house, and I'll just pay the bill. And so he came to help, and Greg must have been summer vacation, and Greg was there to work that day. And so this maybe 28-year-old athlete that was a minister worked with my son for an eight-hour day and called me at the end of the day and said, I've never been so embarrassed in my life. He said, your son Greg started at a pace that I thought was actually hilarious because I thought he was putting on a show, and then he did it for eight straight hours. He said, I've honestly never seen anything like it. And I said, yeah. I said, he didn't take that after me. He took that after my dad. I have spurts of that, but my dad was like that. And what was interesting is Greg is really, he's really hard to work with in that sense, because that's what he is. He's really a machine. And I've heard him say of Aaron, the only person I know that can outwork me is Aaron. So I'm excited when I see that, because I know there's a lot of things that can go wrong in your life. But if you have the ability to work hard, and you're determined to see something to the end, then you'll always be able to make a comeback. And that's an important thing to know about yourself. So I hope you guys read The Richest Man in Babylon, and I think you can see why you might want to revisit it once in a while, because there's a lot of things in there that seem to be so basic, but they're so necessary. And every time I've made a mistake and walked away from a pile of money, it was one of those things that I did wrong. And so in January, I make an attempt to read this book every year, because I don't want that to happen to another quarter million dollars of my money. I want to thank you guys for joining us today. Aaron, did you want to take any questions? Or?
You know, I put it out there about 5 minutes ago, and I haven't heard anything today. So
okay.
We'll wait a few more minutes, a few seconds, I guess, if anybody wants to type some in the little chat area. But I haven't got any.
Okay. Well, that's fine, too.
It's Friday. I'm just having a hard time grasping that August is almost over.
Well, this whole year has flown by, but that seems to be the way it goes.
Sure.
I'm glad that we've got 3 more weeks left in this goal, 60-day goal process, and that's like we get the peak at the finish line.
So yeah,
we're over halfway there.
I know. I still have not heard back from Diana Nyad's team about if she's going to end up bringing that to Geffen Playhouse in LA. She just had that really small showing in a very small theater. Like, we only had 6 days notice, and I couldn't get it together. But if I hear something more, I'll definitely try to put that together.
Maybe we could get her to come to the Fox.
Right? Hey.
Why not?
Yeah. Who knows? I should probably throw that out at her. That's funny. Very good idea, Dad.
Yeah.
Like, I need to be involved in one more thing.
Yeah, one more thing you need to do. Well, you know what? I actually really like that lady, so
that
would be a worthwhile thing to see.
Who knows? Live Nation, I think, is based out in L.A., and maybe they would be willing to put her on the road in a lot of houses that they control, little different theaters around the country. That'd be interesting.
I didn't intend to do this, but last night, thinking about what I was going to say today, I was up and that documentary was on again. So while I was working on this, I was watching that amazing lady do her thing. I like that part when she's driving back from one of the failures and she says, you know, that pisses me off. And it's just like, wow, 15 minutes out of the water, the lady's already contemplating getting back in the water. So
yeah, I like that one. And then when she tells her friend she wants to try again, and her friend gets all pissed off, it's so great. She's like, really?
Well, you know what's interesting about that friend is that friend was a world class athlete.
Yeah.
Too. So they were two peas in a pod, and yet Diana was like the craziest lady that lady had ever seen. And so it's just amazing what's inside of people. You know, what the capacity is when you really want to go after something. That's why we had her come to our event. I just was blown away by the commitment to do something that you literally have invented this yourself. I mean, it wasn't like everybody wanted to swim from China or from Cuba to Florida. It was her own made-up goal that she just would not let go of until she did it.
Yeah, well, you know what? Jack Fullerton just sent something in. Do you have any thoughts on people who come and learn from us over the past 30 years but have not put the activity in? Well, they just don't produce. They're seminar junkies but don't pull the trigger.
You know, and since it's Jack Fullerton, I'll reference Jim Rohn. Jim Rohn, one of the greatest teachers for me ever, said that He actually had to stop worrying about when people didn't get it or didn't do it, because he knew that was going to happen. He said, there are going to be people that meet me at the door and say, I've heard this all before, what a waste of time. And there'll be someone else that walks behind them and says, what an amazing teacher and information. I'm going to change my whole life. And then they go do it. And it's the same information, but I guess the seed wasn't ready to get planted, then grow. And I guess the goal of a teacher is to work on the message and make sure it's of value and realize that it's going to hit a small percentage of an audience that's going to provide huge benefits and change their life, but that it doesn't negate that that's still what you want to do, even though the change percentage-wise might be small. It's not small for that individual life. When I heard Jim Rohn speak for the first time, he changed my whole financial life. What if I was the only one that got it that night? I'm glad he showed up. I really am.
Well, Muhammad Mamoun, who came to the Millionaire Maker the last time we did it, him becoming a millionaire changed the outlook for his entire family. So it's like a virus. It spreads. People watch.
Well, that's the thing, too. You do have a legacy component to being successful because your family does watch it. It's not that they just get the advantage of, okay, we get to live in a cool house or whatever. Somehow they view a successful model and can choose to replicate something they're seeing and then add to it. So it's like you've started out at a new level, and now like you guys have done, you've gotten to see a certain model, but now you have your own goals and aspirations, but you've had a higher starting point because of the effect that people that took the time to train me have had on my life.
Yeah.
And that's why you share, is on the hopes that you reach out and touch somebody next.
Agreed. Very cool. All right. Well, we're just right about perfect time, a full hour. So I guess we'll wind it down, and I'm going to put the recording up just in case you missed anything. And the book for next week is The Servant, not The Servant Leader. I had a few phone calls about that. So The Servant by James C. Hunter. Leadership is actually in the subtitle. So if you're looking for that, I just had it wrong in the book. So with that, anything else to add?